Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the First Celtic Blog podcast with me, your host, James Forrest, to discuss all the issues affecting our club. Now, for this opener, you have got just me. So I'm going to basically sit here, drink coffee and ramble. Little bit. This is an experimental thing we're doing here. Never done this before in my entire life. Never even attempted it. So there are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be hiccups. The first one that I put out was the special on the situation at Ibrox. And I think that went reasonably well. But that was just me basically sitting here with a script that I'd written, speaking to the microphone. This is going to be more spontaneous. And so there are going to be more fuck-ups here. There are going to be more problems. And there are going to be more teething difficulties. But it's like everything else. The more used to this I get, the better I'm going to get at it. And once myself and my friends can get the schedules reconciled, we're going to have some regulars going to come on and spare you the pain of having to listen to me and nothing but me. In terms of the specials, I want to talk about that for a second. There are podcasts out there who do what this one is intending to do in terms of like having a round table discussion with various friends of mine and various people from around Celtic cyberspace. But I want to do something a little bit different on this. So I'm going to talk about a lot of Scottish football issues that other podcasts might not talk about. I'm going to do occasional specials where it's just me focused on one subject, as it was with the first one. In the main, this will be about Celtic. But Scottish football, believe it or not, is bigger than us. And there are more issues out there than cover just our club. But I believe that all of those issues affect our club. I'll give you an example. Managerial situation at Aberdeen and Hibs this season, right? That definitely affects us. The level of competition we get in the Scottish League directly impacts on the kind of players that we can sign, on the kind of preparation we have for Europe, on the money that the league can bring in. These teams have to be doing things better. I'm also going to talk at some point about the national team and the abject state of the national team as we come out of another disastrous Euros, and it was disastrous. I mean, no one's even going to dispute that it was disastrous. Expectations weren't exactly high, but we missed the mark by miles. With negative tactics, a poorly set up national team. I think we missed the mark in terms of the manager's decision making during the games. The fact that we registered, I think it was 3 shots on target over the 3 matches, or 4 shots on target. Absolutely appalling. Appalling numbers. So there are big problems with the national setup, but those problems are bigger than they seem. And the trouble that we are in is much deeper than it seems at first glance. And I'm going to talk about that at some point in the future. And I'm going to do a special on that, because I think that is a serious issue. And we are part of the problem, and I'm going to be honest about that. I genuinely believe that Celtic are part of the problem, because our youth academy is failing not just Celtic, but the country. We've given more players careers than just about any other club in the land. When you look around Scottish football and you see the number of players who started out at the Celtic academy making a living in the game, it's tremendous on one hand, but so very, very few of those players would have been good enough to play first team football at Celtic, and they are certainly not good enough to take the national team to the next level. And that's a problem, and we have to do our bit, not just for Scotland, but we have to get better for our own sake as well. And so I think that discussion is germane to, you know, the situation facing us as a club. But that's a subject for another day. For today, I'm going to talk briefly about last season and then about this season. Now, the season just passed was a triumph, but it wasn't an unqualified triumph. We had a terrible summer. We made, I think it was a dozen signings. And by the end of the season, not a single one of those signings was playing regular first team football. Now, we all know what happened. We all know whose fault it was. There are people who sit in ivory towers and have a pop at angry bloggers who were the cheerleaders for that abject summer that we just had, and who try to tell the rest of us that that's how it has to be, that Celtic does things in the proper way and this has worked and delivered X number of titles. I would stipulate that it is good management and the ability to craft a squad and a winning unit that leads to titles and trophies and other things. But that coach, that management team has to be backed properly. And the summer was a complete and utter disaster in that regard. And it wasn't just that we made 12 mediocre to bad signings. It was the fact that those signings were directly contrary to what the manager himself said he wanted and said he needed to advance the team. Now, for a moment, let's consider that Brendan Rodgers inherited a treble-winning team. This is the defence that some people will put forward, that he inherited a treble-winning team and that a manager who inherited a treble-winning team should automatically have been successful. That's bollocks, I'm sorry. It's bollocks. That team was built to do a specific job and play a specific style of play under a specific manager. That is how good teams become great teams and win everything in sight. They're constructed for one purpose by one single-minded, determined individual who picks every single part of it. Like an architect designing and overseeing the construction of a building. If you give that guy substandard parts, parts that can't do the job that he has in mind for them, you're going to get a substandard job. Brendan Rodgers was working with someone else's blueprint. And if it was as simple as he could just have played the Ange style of play, why did we even bother going and getting an elite level manager like Brendan Rodgers in the first place? We could have hired Derek McInnes and told him, play Ange style play. Just play the way Ange did. And it would have all worked out fine. That is not how it's done. It was only after January when Rodgers was able to bring in a striker who could play his template. Only when he was able to bring in a guy on the right side of the pitch who he trusted. It was only when he was able to make the tweaks to the playing system and get those across to the team and start fitting it around the ideas that he had that we improved. And that improvement is why we won the double. But it's undeniable that he had to do that with last season's team. And that was just wrong. That was just wrong. We signed 12 players January. Had 12 players in the summer. That should have enhanced the squad. Instead, he was forced to play with a weakened version of last season's squad. That's unbelievable. That can't happen again. The direct consequence of Brendan having to use last season's team is that once we got injuries, he had to fit those suboptimal signings who were not signed to play his system. Who were not signed, in fact, with any system in mind by where I'm standing. The problem was that once Brendan had to adapt those players to his system, we had the mid-season slump. The mid-season slump where we traded away a 7-point lead to find ourselves behind. Now, we were saved by the January window on the signing of Adam Ida. And at that point, Brendan was able to make some tweaks. We got some players back who had been out. At that point, he was able to make some tweaks. And we saw how differently we played. I did an article on this where I talked about the difference prior to the mid-season slump and how we played coming out of it. And it was basically, it was about numbers. When we upped our goals per game average by just one goal, everything changed. I think by the, up to that point, I think we had been scoring an average of 2.5 goals a game or something. And it was after the team was back to being relatively strong and Brenda was able to add Kuhn and Ida, that we upped our game, went to that next level, and took the average to 3.5 or 3.6. And that's what changed the dynamic. That's what turned the tide. That's why we won the league. The turning point for me was Motherwell. When Ida's late goal put us in the lead, and then we saw Palmer ghost in and scoring his goal. And I think at that point, I started thinking, yeah, this is going to be okay. If we can maintain this tempo and this direct style, this is going to be okay. We're going to get here. Ibrox was the moment that I knew we would win it when we left Ibrox with a 3-3 draw, and I was disappointed, as most of us were, that we didn't win that day. But coming out of that game, I genuinely thought that was it. I thought, this is it. We're going to win this. And of course, being able to beat them at Celtic Park, once we had our noses in front, we were never going to lose it. We're never going to lose it. And people are going to say that, you know, oh, they dropped points and, you know, Ross County and Dundee did us a favour. It's bollocks, basically, as everyone's well aware. We went on that winning run at the end of the season, and that winning run would have made us champions regardless of what happened over there. Regardless of what they did, that winning run would have won us the title. Cup final day was tense, but it was ultimately special because we got over the line. The triumph in winning the double wasn't just a vindication of Brendan and a message to the people running our club that if he gets the backing and he gets the support, that we will win things and we will continue to dominate Scottish football. It was a message to the club at the other side of the city that for all their big talk, we're still far and away a better team. We're still far and away a bigger club. They're playing catch up all summer long. Even if we've gone backwards and we haven't signed anybody yet, they're still playing catch up. And they'll be playing catch up for a long time to come. I don't see how they catch us if we utilise our full strength. That, of course, is the question. Will we utilise our full strength? I think we will, but we'll have to wait and see if I'm proved right. But the ultimate triumph, I think, belongs to Brendan Rodgers. And it's not just the triumph of being the double winning manager. He has seen off another Ibrox boss. He has another Ibrox managerial scalp, another trophy for his wall. I think that Philippe Clement is in a lot of trouble. We'll get to their situation in a bit, but I think he's in a lot of trouble because Brendan has his number. Brendan so obviously has his number. And I don't think that he's going to be bested by this guy. I think Brendan is going to own him as he's owned so many other Ibrox bosses before him. I think by the time this season ends, the coming season, I think Philip Clement will have joined Beale and Warburton and Gerrard and all the rest of them and leaving with their tails between their legs. Because this guy's just not going to lose to these people. No way. No way. The fact that his record at the end of the season, a season where it was Brendan who was told that he had everything to prove, that his previous record meant nothing. Well, what does his record mean now? It's now 9 trophies out of a possible 10. And in 5 games against them last season, 4 wins and a draw. I don't know how they catch him. I don't know how they stop us while this guy is at the helm. But that was last season. Where are we right now. We have a number of players who have just come back from international duty, and we have a number of players who are still on international duty. Now, as I said, Scotland's woes are well known to us all. They had an absolutely dire Euros. Some in the media tried to make Anthony Ralston the scapegoat for the first game. They've tried to make Callum McGregor the scapegoat for everything that has gone wrong, basically. But in the end, I think most Scotland fans recognise a collective failure when they see it, and that was a collective failure in every way. From the manager down to the players, and don't forget that most of these players play in England. Most of the national team right now plays in England. Steve Clark's got a real penchant for picking players south of the border, as if they are automatically better than the players who play up here. And it was the big name players, the guys who play Premier League football every week, who I think really let us down, really badly let us down. John McGinn, Scott McTominay, Andy Robertson in particular, I thought, had a terrible time of it. And from a Scotland fan point of view, that was really disappointing. Everybody knows my feelings on Billy Gilmore. I'm not even going into that subject. I've written literally thousands of words on that, I think, and I don't want to talk about it any further. But yeah, everyone recognises a collective failure when they see it, and that was a collective failure. And so blaming individual players, especially Celtic players, as fun as it might be for the media, there are serious long-term questions that have to be asked. And as I said, I'm going to do a special on that. I found Ewan Murray's comments on it particularly fascinating and interesting, because he alone of all Scottish hacks, he got right to the core of this. He drilled down and delivered a message of doom, basically. It may not be what people want to hear, but I think it's what people needed to hear. People needed a reality check and a wake-up call. And Ewan Murray, at least, has tried to provide that. As I say, I will talk about that at a later date, but I would advise everyone to go and find Ewan Murray's articles on the Euros and read them, and really read them. And while you're reading them, there's a piece by Barry Ronnie about the revolution that happened in Austrian football under Rangnick. And that, when you read the Scotland one and then that, the contrast is fascinating. There is a third piece, should you want to really do a deep dive, which is about Italy's performance at the Euros and how the Italian FA is now talking about ripping it all up and starting again in the same way that the Germans did when England beat them 5-1. And the way the Brazilians did when that revised, renewed German national side annihilated them by scoring 7. See, this is what good associations do. This is what professional associations do. They go back to the drawing board. When they suffer a national humiliation, they don't just accept it and give the manager a pat on the back, as we seem to have done here. They go back to the drawing board and they say, well, is this down to him? Is this down to the players? Or is there a deeper issue here? Is there something in the grassroots that we need to go and dig for and rip up and replant the whole field? And this is what's happened in Austria. The Germans have done it to an extent. The Italians are going to try and do it, apparently. And maybe it's time the Scotland did the same. Maybe it's time the SFA showed some leadership. My God, radical revolutionary thought there, right? But maybe it's time. Maybe this is it. I'm not holding my breath, but maybe it is. Anyway, that was the Euros. The subject that we are all talking about at the moment, the two subjects, are the likely departures from the Celtic squad on top of the guys who've already left, and the positions that we badly need to fill. And there is, of course, a corollary question to those, which is, do we trust the board to support the boss in getting the job done? Let's start with likely departures. Gustav Lagerbielke is going to go next. That's probably in the post. I mean, Haksabanovic is gone. We know that O's probably got a foot out the door. The Belgians are going to buy him. And it's good that we're going to get good money for him, because we're going to invest every single penny of it back into the team. Lagerbielke is probably going to go next. I don't know that Naroki will go this summer, but he probably should, because a guy who finds himself behind Liam Scales and Stephen Welsh in the pecking order doesn't have a long-term future at Celtic Park. The talk continues that we're going to lose Matt O'Reilly. The Southampton's alleged bid hasn't been submitted yet, but apparently it's on the way and it's going to be 20 million plus. I think that's an insulting offer personally. If Celtic have set a price of 30, we should stick to our guns and we should not accept less. But we'll see what happens. I mean, it's entirely possible that Matt will want to go to Southampton, and he may come to us and say, I think that it's time. I'll be very disappointed if that's the case. But that's a to be continued. Who else is going to go? Lewis Palmas had a good Copa America. If we get an offer for him, I think he will go. I don't think he fits Brendan Rodgers' style of play. I don't think he's got enough pace. I don't think he's aggressive enough. Certainly in terms of his technical skill, he has got that. I mean, he is a great crosser of the ball. He can strike a ball well. He's very good technically. But some of the more physical attributes that Rodgers looks for just aren't there in this guy. And I would think that his game time is going to be limited. Because I certainly think that we need another couple of players out wide. But, you know, I think if a good offer comes in for him, he's gone. Beyond that, it's difficult to say. I think that a lot of last season signings will go out on loan. I don't see what Odin Thiago Holm is hanging around for. He is one of the bigger disappointments. And he, of course, was signed before we even had a manager. And one of the most bizarre pieces of transfer business in our recent history. But he came with a pretty good pedigree. He just hasn't shown anything that leads me to believe that he will be a success. And yeah, it's early days. It's one season. And he hasn't played a lot of games. That's why I haven't seen a lot of them. Maybe sending him out on loan for a year and seeing what kind of player we get back might be better than jettisoning him completely. In terms of players who will be jettisoned completely, I don't believe Kwon is coming back. You know, in spite of a few people who got carried away when he had a couple of good games for St Mirren, that is not a player who's going to lead us into the Champions League, I'm afraid. Yang has raw talent, and you can see that. He's also big and aggressive. And for that reason, I think we will keep him. I think there is something that we can work with there. And I would like to see him get a chance in the team in the coming year. Tilio, I could not tell you. A signing that is about as baffling as any that we've made in our history. We paid a couple of million pounds for this guy playing in the Australian League. That's almost like someone's playing Football Manager with real money. That person, of course, is no longer employed by Celtic, which is almost certainly for the best. Other than that, I don't know. I mean, there will be a lot of departures. That's just the way of it. And Brendan's right about it. And Brendan said that this feels like a transitional summer. It shouldn't be a transitional summer. But we always kind of thought it would be, and it always kind of looked like one. So that does appear to be the case. We've, of course, already lost a number of key players, including Joe Hart, which is heartbreaking, no pun intended. Bernardo and Ida, we don't know if we're going to bring them back. We don't know if we're going to be able to bring them back. There are reports, which you can take seriously or not, that Bernardo can't agree a deal, won't agree a deal on the wages. I think that those reports, by the way, are shady to say the least, because the claim that he's on some kind of mega wage as a Benfica reserve seems flatly ridiculous to me. I don't think we can pay much attention to that. But there is something that's holding that deal up, and there is some kind of problem that's delaying it. Adam Ida. I love Adam Ida. He has been the surprise package of the season. Brendan knew exactly what he was getting in this guy. And that speaks to Brendan's blueprint and Brendan's plan and how we can have faith in it if he gets the players he wants. The thing is that if Adam Ida can do that job, I don't have a doubt in the world that there are other players out there who can do that job. And Brendan has to balance whether or not Ida's worth waiting for with what we need in the here and now. And that's a decision only the boss can make. And that's a decision I think he will have to think long and hard about. The Champions League group games don't come until after the window shuts. And it's the final registration deadline before those games get played. So if it was just the Champions League, we could probably wait till the last day if that's what it took to get Adam Ida. If Adam Ida is the guy the boss definitely wants. But while there are alternative players out there, we should be going and getting the process started just in case. It's going to take too long to get Ida, and it's going to be an... it's not going to be a sure thing, let's just say. We all know, of course, that if Ode departs, we need another striker. Now, I'm on the record with this one, and I think a lot of you guys agree with me when I say that that person should probably be Bojan Miovski at Aberdeen. We know what Miovski can do. We've seen the talent that the guy's got. He's 25, he's an international. He's physically strong and aggressive. He's got the pace that Rodgers likes, the power that Rodgers likes. And he's proved that he can score goals. And I think that if we started the new season with Kyogo, Ida and Miovski, I think most people would regard that as a title-winning forward line, and one that we would be fairly comfortable and confident going into European games with. We need someone, I think we need someone wide left, especially if Lewis Palmer goes, because right now we've got Maeda out there on his own, and James Forrest is an able backup, I'm sure, but we have to always remember that James is now racing the clock in terms of how long he's got left in his career, and that may not be something that we can completely depend on. On the right-hand side, we've got Kuhn and Yang. A lot of people are very unconvinced by Kuhn at the moment. Even more are unconvinced by Yang, so it's possible that we could sign someone else out there. There comes a point, of course, where you have too many players in one position, and it's overkill to have them all in the squad. If we sign a decent right-sided player, then over the course of the campaign, a decision's got to be made on either Kuhn or Yang, and one of them's got to be jettisoned at the end of the season. On the left side, the need is clearly far more critical, urgent, whatever you want to call it. If it's not going to be Palmer, then it's Maeda with Forrest as a backup, unless people are seriously suggesting that we bring back Mikey Johnson. That's always a possibility, and one that I won't discount. But Mikey seems to have done what Mikey does. Mikey had gone to West Brom. He had stunned people with how good he is. He scored some otherworldly goals, and then his performances fell through the floor. And that tends to be Mikey's pattern. You know, Mikey will come and he'll do well and he'll play well and he'll look like a world beater for a while, and then he'll fade. And it will be a tragedy for him and for Celtic if he comes back to the club and finds himself warm in the bench again. I don't think that any of us wants that to happen. And I would be very surprised, therefore, if Mikey was to return. The left-back position is screaming for a good backup, or indeed a player who can finally do what no one has done so far and rip the position from Greg Taylor's very, very, very dedicated grip. I spoke to Greg Taylor at the end of the season at Celtic Park on the final day. And what comes across when you listen to Greg Taylor talk is his absolute assurance and self-confidence. He thinks that he will have the beating of anybody that we bring in. And it's interesting to actually listen to how he talks about reacting to constant speculation and being under that kind of pressure all the time. And he handles it brilliantly, by the sounds of it. He expects it, and he deals with it well. And that's why I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that anybody we bring in will automatically start in front of him, which is why I say a backup, first and foremost. because whoever it is who comes in has everything to prove. And they have to demonstrate that they're better than Greg Taylor. And that's not going to be as easy as a lot of people think. Taylor has made that position his own, and he will fight with every breath he can muster to hang on to it. And I, for one, would not bet against him. Still, last season, Copenhagen, who had just come off winning a double, prepared in the summer in exactly the way we should have prepared in our summer. They identified the four key areas of their team, and they went out and signed experience in those four key positions. And not only did they get out of their Champions League group, they got out of a dreadfully difficult Champions League group in which they beat Manchester United and sent them out of Europe. And two of the positions that they filled were the left midfield and the left back position. And they went and signed experienced players in both. The left midfielder they signed was Mo Elanoussi on a free transfer. I believe the left back also was a player they signed on a free transfer. But experienced, 28, 29 years old. And if we're going to get this right, that's the kind of signings that we have to make. Those are the kind of signings that we traditionally don't make, because they don't have a resale value and they don't add value to the squad, blah, blah, blah. But they do add value to the squad. Of course they do. Aaron Moy came in on a free transfer, player in his 30s, guy the manager knew. And he enhanced the team massively before leaving at the end of the season. Massively. And these are the kind of players Brendan wants to bring in and that we should be bringing in. There's a lot of talk today that fans need to be patient, as angry bloggers have told to be patient. Because the only players who are available right now are players who don't have clubs and players who no one wants. Well, one of the players who doesn't have a club is Scott McKenna, who I'm already on record the same with enhanced hours. There are numerous other players on free transfers throughout Europe who would definitely walk into our first team squad. It's laziness and arrogance to believe that there are no players available in the Bosman market at this moment in time who would enhance us. Players no one wants. There are clubs in England who are finally being forced to confront financial reality, and they're cutting their budgets because they have to. And a lot of the players that they no longer want are players who, likewise, would enhance our team. It's a failure of imagination. That's all it is. It's a failure of imagination. It's the same mindset that keeps on saying, oh, Tierney's available, we should go back and get Tierney. Or Hudson-Edouard might be available, we should go and get Hudson-Edouard. Or Jota might be available, we could go back and get Jota. It's the same sort of mindset that thinks that going backwards and signing players who have already been at Celtic Park is the way to move forward. There are better footballers out there right now who we could go and get right now who would be better than the 12 we signed in the summer. Guys who would be able to get into their team and hold down a place in our team. Scott McKenna would walk into the Celtic team right now. He also, by the way, signed for Copenhagen last season on a 6-month loan deal towards the end of his contract. But. The question is, do we trust the board to deliver that? Well, I don't think that should be the question of the summer. I think the question is, do we trust the judgment of the manager? Because if Brendan Rodgers has not yet put his foot down and taken total control of this process, then that man needs his hair examined. Because they could have got him sacked last season with what he let them do. And he surely is not going to let them do it again. If all the reports are to be believed, he has fought and won his internal battle. And so the question is not, do we trust the board? The question is, do we trust the boss? And I think that we can, and I think it will be a good summer window for that reason. Aside from the domestic prize that awaits us if we get this right. It's progress in next season's Champions League. Now, the Champions League has a new format this year. And I'm not convinced that we're going to love it. I'm not convinced that we're going to like it at all. I've written about this quite a bit. But I'm still amazed how many people don't actually understand what this is going to look like. It's bizarre. The system that we've adopted is a system that has been tried in various other sports. This is the first time it's ever been done in football. When critics complained that it's not a system built for competition sport as we are used to it, a UEFA official actually told the reporter that it works in chess, as if that's the same thing. And yes, it's indeed it is a system that is used in chess. I just don't know how we are going to enjoy using it. It's already changed several times, by the way. When it was first mooted in and when it was first getting brought in, we're going to play 10 games and then we're going to play 8 in the group stages, just 2 up from the current system. I think one of the reasons why they dumped the idea of playing 10 games is very little to do with the impact on the schedule. Because this is going to impact the schedule enormously. But I think it has less to do with impacting the schedule than if we were playing 10 games. There would be some justification for asking why we don't just have 6 team groups. Which would be much easier to understand, which would be much better to watch, and which would give us back again one of the things that we're going to lose out of this competition, which is being able to sit and watch a live Champions League group stage draw. Instead, this is going to be done by computer, and we're not going to see any of it. We're not going to know how the draw was made. We're not going to know what there is, I'm sure, a criteria and a kind of mathematical model that underpins it all, which will be explained to us, and it'll all be gobbledygook and it won't make a single bit of sense, and most people will just zone out of it and switch off from it. I've tried reading about it and I'm damned if I can fully comprehend it. I do know that we're going to play 8 games. We're going to play 4 at home. We're going to play 4 away. We will not play the same team twice. In other words, it'll be 4 teams at home, 4 teams away, and there'll be 8 different teams. We will play, the Champions League will be laid out in groups as it is right now. We will be in pot 4. But for all the people who are saying that if our rivals join us, oh, they'll be in pot 2. Whoa. Streamers and celebratory hats on. It won't make a blind bit of difference, because a pot 4 team and a pot 2 team, it's going to be negligible if there is any difference at all, because each team will play 2 teams from every other pot, regardless of what pot they themselves are in. So a pot 1 team will play 2 teams from pot 1, just as we will. And 2 teams from pot 2, and 2 teams from pot 3, and 2 teams from pot 4. That's how it's going to work. So don't listen to anybody who tells you that if they can make it, they have some advantage because they're in pot 2. It's bullshit, I'm afraid. The problem is that outside of pot 4, there are no easy draws. There are no safe draws. A lot is going to depend on the 4 teams you get at home. If you're going to get the super clubs, I mean, you're going to get a super club. You're going to get 2 super clubs in pot 1. That's almost guaranteed. You're going to probably get one, at least one super club in pot 2. So the ideally what you're looking for is you'll get a super club in pot 1. You would like one game home, one game away. I'm sure that's how it will work. One game from each pot will be home, one will be away. So the home ones are going to be critical. In pot two, you want the Super Club at home. You do not want to have to go and play an away game against them and risk the first three out of your eight games being a complete write-off. Do not want that to happen. So you want the Super Club at home from pot two. And pot three and four is luck of the draw to a degree. But there are going to be opportunities in there. Some of the pot three teams are going to be teams on our level that we should have a good chance of beating. Teams in pot four, take your pick. I mean, as the Champions League is a massive level up from the Europa League. It's such a gigantic step up. I couldn't believe it 2 years ago when the Ibrox club thought that they would breeze into it and they would be able to make a splash in it. It was fantasy land stuff because the level is so much higher that I had a feeling they were going to get trounced no matter who they got. And they have, of course, finished with the worst record of any team ever to take part in the group stages. And I was probably the least surprised person in Scotland about that outcome. So there are no dream draws here and there are no nightmare draws. No, really. There are going to be opportunities. This is why we can't afford to go into it half-cocked or unprepared. If we put our best foot forward, we're going to have a chance to rack up a lot of coefficient points and make a lot of money. It will depend, to a certain extent, on avoiding the super clubs and the away games, getting them at home where we've at least got a puncher's chance. But we're going to have to be better than we've been in quite some time to get anything, and we're going to have to do better business in the summer than we've done in quite some time. The question as to whether our rivals will join us in the competition at all is still wide open. The first qualifying game seems relatively straightforward, although their fans are not particularly confident. They're going to have to bed in a new team. They're probably going to have to do it playing away from Ibrox, which negates one of their biggest advantages straight away. The record in games outside of Ibrox, even in the Europa League, is nowhere near as good as their home record has been. Their home record is like their secret weapon. And you take them away from Ibrox for those first two qualifiers, and their chances going through are radically reduced. The only minor concern, and it is a minor concern, because the money we'll make in the Champions League should put us on a different planet from them if they're not there with us. The only minor quibble is that the Europa League will work the exact same way as the Champions League. Eight games, four pots, two teams from each pot, and in that less than rarefied competition, they've got a chance of adding more coefficient points and winning more games. That's basically the truth of it. I wouldn't trade our place for their place, but their place, by virtue of the competition they're in, is going to be slightly easier to navigate than ours. That's just a fact. If they don't make it, they have got a slightly easier time of it. That is if their club doesn't self-destruct in the meantime. Because the situation with their stadium is pretty astonishing. It's clearly a colossal fuck-up. And they can try and dress it up however they like, but there is no dressing up the scale of the problem that they've got here, or the difficulties that they're going to have. Their club is in a lot of bother. How long this lasts and how much it costs them to play somewhere else are the only X-factor variables here. But this is not the kind of start that you would want, especially in a rebuild season. And in a rebuild season, where I look at the state of their rebuild so far, and I don't see a lot for their fans to be optimistic about. These are the kind of project signings that if we had made them, I'd be pulling my hair out, to be honest, and most Celtic fans would be. But I'll go you one better than that. If Aberdeen or Hearts or Hibs had signed these players, I wouldn't care, and the media wouldn't care, and there'd be no hype about AC Milan regulars and players who could play for Real Madrid. As I said when they signed their Brazilian left-back Efe, players do not usually reach the Bernabeu and an unveiling ceremony via the Cypriot League and the SPFL. Anyone who read that story and believed that that outcome is remotely likely needs to go for a lie down in a dark room. It's bonkers. But this is how it always goes. Every signing they make over there is hyped as if he were a world beater. Do you remember the reaction when we signed Nicholas Kuhn? Radio Clyde and other outlets went out and found themselves someone who would trash this guy before he'd even kicked a ball. You never get that with their signings. Never. You will never, ever, ever, ever see a media report like that about one of their signings. But even in attempting to make these signings sound good, they had to damn them with faint praise. The guy Effie, the Cypriot League left back, the reports on him are that he has got promise, that in an attacking sense, he looks good. Defensively, he is suspect. Defensively suspect in the League of Cyprus. God help them if they have to play this guy in a Champions League qualifier. But you will never read that sort of analysis in the Scottish mainstream media, because their entire reason for existing, to me at times, seems like it's more about boosting an Ibrox and giving the best possible account of the business that they're doing that they possibly can. It's bizarre. But that is where we are. That's where we've always been. They will win the pre-season cup. There is no question about that. Doesn't matter how well we do, no matter how good our signings are. It'll be all the excitement is on the other side of the city. Wherever the other side of the city is. And the other, for all we know right now, the other side of the city could be Edinburgh. Because they may have to play a month, 2 months, ad infinitum number of months at Murrayfield. We don't know that. They don't even know that. So, you know, if I were in their shoes, I'd be shaking in them quite a bit at the moment. The story from outside Glasgow is nothing to be excited about. The story from outside Glasgow continues to be horrendous. Horrendous. Hibs have appointed yet another rookie boss. If there is an overarching vision at that club, I don't know anyone who can tell me what it is. Aberdeen have made an adventurous appointment, you could say, if you wanted to be generous. That could be hit or it could be spectacular miss. If it's a spectacular miss this time. If it's a spectacular miss this time, surely Aberdeen fans will conclude that it's not the guy in the dugout who's the big problem. If the Hibs appointment is a disaster, their own fans should surely come to a similar conclusion. Hearts. Well, what does it say about Hearts? Hearts are sticking with their man. They're standing by Stephen Naismith because third place finish and two reasonably decent performances in the cup apparently is good enough for Hearts. And in the meantime, they have Stephen Naismith in the dugout. They don't know how to be anything else. Under their current board of directors, they don't know how to be anything else. They've reached the limit of their ambition. And Stephen Naismith, he's not going to take them any further forward. Clubs in this league should not be appointing rookie managers. So when it comes to outside Glasgow, I don't know. I don't see any hope at all that we're going to get a better standard of football from these teams. I don't get any sense outside of the two in Glasgow. I just don't get any real sense that there's ambition or a plan. They seem to make up as they go along and they seem to get by on getting by. And as I said at the top of the show, that doesn't help us. It doesn't work for us. If the standard of the league is piss poor, and these teams are offering no threat and no challenge, that this is why we can't raise our game when we walk onto the European stage. Because we don't get tested most weeks. These clubs barely test each other. Hearts finished the season, last season, on a kind of point score that should embarrass them. But instead, it's Stephen Naismith's successful season. It wasn't a successful season. They didn't win anything. They finished third. So, you know, forgive me for them. Forgive me that maybe I just don't get it. Maybe it's me who's missing something. But I don't think you can call it a successful season when you don't win things. When you, the best you can do is get to a cup final and basically surrender in it, which is what they did. So maybe it's just me. But I don't see any hope for clubs outside of Glasgow this year doing anything remarkable. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that the Aberdeen boss rolls out of town and blows everybody away. I hope it's a phenomenal season for them. But I just doubt it. I just don't see signs of life anywhere else. And I really want to see signs of life. You're Aberdeen 7th last season, Hibs 8th. Aberdeen won 12 games, Hibs won 11. Hearts won 20 out of 38 with 10 losses. Most of them against one team, but we're not going to go into that. So yeah. For me, the season's all going to be about us and them again. But mostly us, hopefully. We finished last season. We finished that triumphant campaign on 93 points. So Brendan will be aiming to beat that this year. If we win 90 points, I think that puts the league in the bag, considering their team's on a full-scale rebuild. And they usually take time and they're usually very difficult. Unless you have a guru, an Ange Postecoglou type guru or a Rodgers type guru who can come in and work magic. I don't think Clement is a magician. He said it himself, I am a football manager, I am not a magician. No shit, Sherlock. I'm going to see the proof of that this season. But there's going to be some question as to whether he's a football manager by the time this season ends. But, yeah. So, ladies and gents, I have rambled on for an hour. And I did not want to ramble on for an hour. I don't know if I've enjoyed this. I've talked a lot, and I don't know whether any of it has made any sense. When I play it back, I think there are going to be moments that are going to make me want to pull out what's left of my hair. I hope that I've not driven any of you guys to the point where you're hitting your speakers with a hammer to get me shut up. But the next time you hear my voice on one of these will be for one of the specials, I think. There are two that I want to have a look at. One's about Brendan. And one is on the tricky, thorny subject of anyone but England. And especially after last night, when they came within a millimetre of being out of the Euros and sparing all of us the pain and misery of another week or whatever it will be, of them droning on about how they can still win it. I freely admit that I'm going to be a Swiss for a day. And beyond that, who knows, but the phenomenon of anyone but England is something I've written about a few times before. There are parallels between the way the English national team is covered, the arrogance of certain elements of its media and its support, and our friends across the city. The parallels are there, they are obvious, they are clear. And they distort the picture somewhat. Scotland-England should be a normal football rivalry, and it's never felt like that. It doesn't feel like that. Mostly because, and this will sound paradoxical, and in a sense it is, mostly because England don't have ordinary football rivalries. That makes it very hard to muster any liking for the national team at all. Because whenever it's the playing France, for example, they're fighting a war from 200 years ago. whenever it's Germany, they're fighting one from 80 years ago. Argentina, it's 40 years ago, and on and on and on. These are never simple games of football. This is always a rehashing of some previous conflict in which they were triumphant, and all I can say about them is that they are the worst winners on the planet. Worst winners on the planet. There are people who are insufferable losers. They are insufferable winners, which is why I never want them to win anything ever again, because we won't hear the goddamn end of it in our lifetimes. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure, I think, sitting here talking to you. And this is the first Celtic blog podcast signing off. Ladies and gents, take care.